All units proceed to your post assignments. All units proceed to your post assignments.
Well, we are having some weird technical problems. I think I'm way out of sync too, so I don't know how we're gonna get through this, but let's do our best. It started before the podcast, and I think you're hearing me. Right? You're hearing me, Scott?
I'm hearing you and I'm seeing you. Yep.
Yeah, but you're seeing, you're not necessarily seeing my mouth move at the same time. This is an explosion that occurred a few hours ago in Russia. And have you found out anything about this yet, Scott, as far as anything else at all?
Just that there were some repairs going on and something went bad. Who knows what else?
Something went bad? You mean it was an accident as opposed to it was...
That's all I've gotten out of it so far. There's no evidence of any malfeasance, but...
Oh, all right. Well, that seemed to be the latest, although we do have another article that you just published in the Consortium News, and people can link to that from scottritterextra.com. A lexicon for disaster explains why Russia isn't trusting the United States, and it seems like it's not very likely that any kind of new treaty is imminent, but needs to be. Now, one thing that kind of surprised me is you were saying one of the treaties, I think, expires in 2026, and you were saying, boy, we better start negotiating that now. I would not have imagined it takes that long, but... What do I know? It does take that.
Oh, no. It especially if this treaty expires, so there's no 5-year extension option anymore. They just exercised that option in 2021. If you're going to have a new treaty replace it, there's a couple things. One, Russia's brought on board online a number of new weapon systems that are covered by the treaty, and so. You know, they'll have to be incorporated into any new treaty. And then the U.S. is seeking to modernize its nuclear arsenal. And so that would have to be carried in. And there's new technologies, hypersonics, things that have to be factored in, all of which require a commonality of language. What are we talking about? I mean, the Russians have learned a lesson from the New START treaty. And that's why I wrote about the lexicon of disarmament, the semantics. Words are supposed to mean the same thing in a treaty. So when you have an English text treaty and a Russian text treaty, there's no room for error. Both sides agree. Lawyers go over it. This word means this, and both sides understand exactly what they're talking about. The New START treaty, apparently the United States is redefining words or telling the Russians, no, that's not what we meant when we negotiated it. And the Russians are fed up with this. It's a frustrating process to you can't have any predictability. No assumptions can be made. And pretty much the treaty becomes a useless vehicle because the United States simply will do whatever it wants to do, whenever it wants to do, and claim to be compliant. This is why treaties can't be rushed. Treaties and New START was rushed. Both sides were, the Trump administration allowed the old START treaty to expire. And they were supposed to negotiate this and there wasn't any urgency. So the Bush administration. So Obama stepped in and negotiated this new treaty, but they did it very rapidly. And as a result, the Russians who were, you know, trying to bend over backwards to be seen as, you know, willing to, you know, keep arms control alive, you know, allowed negotiating shortcuts to be taken. And as a result, we end up with the situation we have now where the United States is just claiming that words mean something totally different. It wasn't, you know, that, you know, the Russians are wrong to assume that this means that, et cetera. So no, this treaty, a replacement treaty is going to be, you know, 3, 4, 5 years in the negotiation. And we're not even talking to each other right now, let alone sitting across the table doing meaningful negotiations.
We've been talking a lot about information warfare lately. Is this idea of words not really meaning what they used to mean indicative of the same mindset, or is it something different and just making me think of it?
Well, information warfare is designed to shape perceptions and things of that nature. This is just bad faith negotiations. This is just the United States being a horrific negotiating partner. I mean, to be honest, I would never sign a treaty with the United States right now. We stand for nothing. I mean, the West stands for nothing. We see that with Angela Merkel, you know, the whole Minsk II Accords, you know, oh, I promise we're pushing for a ceasefire. No, she was lying the whole time. She was buying time. And that's the U.S. The U.S. approach to arms control nowadays is not about, you know, mutual reciprocity, you know, doing something that's to the mutual benefit of both parties. I mean, well, sign a treaty. Nobody signs a treaty to give unilateral advantage to the other person. But that's the entire U.S. negotiating position. It's simply, we are seeking unilateral advantage. So we're going to sit down with the Russians and lie to them, cheat, distort, do anything we can so that we come out stronger than the Russians do. We come out ahead of where the Russians are. That's just bad faith negotiations.
All right, let's get to the questions from our beloved audience, and also want to say that somebody said hi to Tori, but it's not Tori backstage today. It's Kevin Michalizzi, who is our information warfare specialist, and we welcome him and thank him for his help. Also, Kevin will be the guest later today on Scenes from the Evolution, our other podcast with Tori as my co-host, and it'll be the final Tuesday Scenes from the Evolution starting January 1st. We're going to switch to Sundays, and we will continue with Ask the Inspector twice weekly at the same time, Tuesdays at this time and Friday nights at 8 p.m. This coming Friday night, December 23rd, is our final episode of the year. We're going to take the last week of December off, so we hope you join us. This is the lightning round in which Scott answers all questions in 3 minutes or less. Friday night is the loquacious version, the verbose version. And this particular episode might be a little sentimental. You know, it's kind of a year-end thing. We might have some electronic hugs going on. Time to reflect on what we've accomplished and looking forward to the next year. So please join us for the Christmas special Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern time. Our first question is from Dimitrios in Greece. There's some math involved here. Now, I know you always say you're just a simple Marine and you're not that good with math. So get ready. Get the calculator out.
And, I got the Marine calculator. We're going.
All right. This guy did some math here, and he's going to challenge you with it. In World War I, France suffered 1,000 casualties per day with a population of 40 million. Yet it fought for 4 years and eventually won with foreign help. So why should we expect that Ukraine, with similar numbers, will collapse due to a lack of manpower?
Well, first of all, the French army during World War I was significantly larger than the French army or the Ukrainian army. War has changed too. We don't line troops up and send them over the trenches in human wave attacks anymore. There's technologies involved. The lethality of combat is such that you don't have the same concentration of troops. You're dispersing your forces over a wider area. You have longer range weapons, better accuracy weapons, etc. So, the military is smaller, but actually it can cover a larger expanse of ground and territory. So you can, you don't have to inflict the numbers of casualties that that you had in the past. War is also, you know, it's total war. The damage done to the French economy was not, you know, you didn't have, you know, drones and cruise missiles blowing up Paris. And yeah, I mean, Paris got hit with some artillery shells, but generally speaking, the depth of France was untouched by the war other than losing people. So it's more than just casualties. It's about the national ability to sustain conflict. The better analogy I would put is France in 1940, the battle for France, smaller numbers of people, but smaller German forces attacking. But at the end, when the Germans broke through and had their major victories in May, June of 1940, France collapsed. And I think that's what we're going to see with Ukraine.
Okay, so I think I got the audio fixed now. Yeah, tell me, Ricardo or Kevin or somebody. We have a series of weird technical problems. Hey, Richie, if you're available after the podcast, maybe I can talk to you about all the weird stuff that happened is happening today. So is it fixed? You can. Well, let me know if it's fixed. Does it sound better to you now, Scott?
You do sound better.
I just changed. Okay, good. All right, so let's move on to the next question. Black Hebrew Khazarian from Wakanda. You know what Wakanda is, Scott? You know that. You know geography.
I know. Black Panther. Yeah.
Okay, it's a fictional location, apparently.
Well, you say it's fictional. Some people believe.
All right, exactly. Shalom, Scott. Oh, yeah, it's Hanukkah, too. Happy Hanukkah. Okay. Judging by your analysis of all incoming information at the moment, what's the likelihood, in percentage, please, do not measure it any other way, Russia will liberate Odessa?
Wow. the pressure.
In percentage, exactly.
Back to marine math percentages. I need that little thing in, you know, with the numbers going over, with me looking confused. I think Odessa, you know, Vladimir Putin gave a press conference a couple months ago, and a Hungarian reporter asked a question about Odessa, should he visit it? And Putin said, you know, the sooner the better, sort of a humorous reference. But then Putin made a comment about Odessa perhaps serving as the basis of a solution, or the, you know, a solution, diplomatic solution, or it was going to be part of the final resolution of the conflict, which tells me that Odessa is sort of like the last chapter of this, which tells me that there's several chapters to be fought beforehand. One of which I believe is the first priority is the liberation of Donetsk. The second priority is the pushing back of the Ukrainian forces out of artillery range of the territories of Donetsk, Lugansk, inclusive of recapturing Kherson, Nikolaev, and pushing the forces back there. And then I think they will, since you're pushing forces back in the Donbass area, I think the Russians will complete the conquest of the north, take Kharkov, maybe push on beyond that. And what I'm trying to say here is there's a lot of work to be done before Odessa emerges as an option. And I think by the time this work is done, you're probably looking at late spring, early summer. And I think the Russians at that point will give the Ukrainians a chance to surrender. And if the Ukrainians don't surrender, then Odessa becomes a option. So if Zelensky stays as president, there will be no surrender. If Zaluzhny replaces Zelensky, I think there will be a negotiated surrender. I do believe that Zelensky will be replaced. The question is when. I'll give it a 60-40 that Zelensky is ousted before the Odessa option is exercised, which means that Odessa won't fall. There will be a surrender. But if so that 40%, then that Odessa will fall by the end of summer.
Okay. Let us go to Poland. Thomas Pritula. He's a regular viewer. I recognize that name. Regarding the Holodomor, what was the, another percentage question. Wow. What was the percentage of Jews in the Soviet security apparatus and in the higher echelons of power at the time? Exact percentage, please, Scott. Be precise if you don't mind.
I don't know.
Here.
I don't know. I don't know. This is one of those I'm going to have to go back and, you know, I'm going to have to do research and all. I simply don't have the answer. I can't answer that.
Oh, that reminds me. I sent you the reminders from last week. Did you? I don't really have them to insert though. You have.
Well, we might do that since we're having technical issues. The reminders may go on pause until the loquacious.
All right, we'll take care of it on Friday night. That's a good idea, actually.
I have some every now and then.
Indeed. You're on a roll, one in a row.
I'm batting 100. Batting
1,000. All right, is lament. My whole life is a lament. Oregon, USA. Don't confuse it with any other Oregon, please. When the U.S. sells weapons to Turkey or Saudi Arabia, how does it prevent those countries from selling access to Russia or China for reverse engineering purposes?
There was a question in there, one of my favorite people. How much money is Putin paying me? Not enough. I mean, I
you know, I didn't even catch that one.
I need more money. Putin, if you're listening, more money, more. Because apparently I'm doing such a good job that it's pissing off people like that. And pay me more so I can give him a real number. And then he can really go freaking out. Dude, if you're worried about how much money I make, why don't you come over here and we can talk about it. You know, you lay out your sources of income, what you do for a living. I'll lay out my sources of income, what I do for a living. What I can guarantee you is anything I may or may not make from the Russians pales in comparison to what I make from other sources. So if you think the Russians or Putin somehow pulling my string, think again. No one pulls my string. You could pull my string. You've pulled my string. You've succeeded. You've pulled my string. I'm going off. Notice I didn't swear yet, Jeff. I'm not being yet. A good boy.
Well, you know, the real question is, you know, with the sanctions and the banks not even doing financial transactions, how does Putin, you know, physically get the money to you? Do you meet in a hotel room and he hands over, you know, a suitcase full of rubles, or, you know, how do you get past the sanctions?
Jeff, you just gave away my secret. It's about secret hotel room meetings.
Yeah.
No, I mean,
pillowcase, and then you walk.
Yeah, let me put it this way: the wire transfers that come in, which are declared by, you know, here's the other thing, dude: the FBI, the Department of Treasury, everybody knows every time I receive a wire transfer from Russia to me in compensation for the articles I write for RT. They know what it is, how it is. So there's nothing secret here. The implication that somehow I'm doing something untoward, illegal, and all that. Stick it where the sun don't shine. See,
well, I was, of course, kidding. But you said something. Now, I thought that you're not even allowed to do what you just said you do. RT can pay you now? I thought that they stopped all transactions.
So RT America shut down.
Uh-huh.
But RT is a Russian media outlet, and they can send a wire transfer. They're not every bank in Russia has been sanctioned, and so there is limited banking thing, but every time it comes in, it gets seized by the U.S. Treasury. Mm-hmm. And then I have to file paperwork showing the contract to show them that there's a legitimate contract, that this doesn't violate sanction anyway. And then about a week and a half later, they release the funds.
Wow,
so
we just learned something. I thought that there's no banks at all handling these transactions, but there is.
No, there's
all these extra hoops. Wow.
You got to go through every single hoop in the world. But, you know, to be honest, it's almost not worth the effort, which, you know, gives you an idea.
It cuts into your hourly rate if you have to devote several hours just to get the money.
Yeah, you know, but I do it for a number of reasons. One, the RT editors have been nothing but fair to me, nothing but fair to me. They don't dictate topics. They don't.
Not like slave driver at Scott Ritter Extra. He's no good.
Scott Ritter Extra. You know, I was supposed to have an article out today, but then that slave driver called up and said, I don't think you should be doing this. So, you know, it's so delayed. I'll have to get it out in time for the loquacious version. But the point is, the Russian editors have been nothing but fair. They've been, there's literally no effort to control what I say, how I say, when I say it. And I do that. And the other reason why I continue to write for them is because of people like the man that wrote that comment. It pisses them off and it makes me very happy. I like it when people like that get very mad at me. speak for writing things.
Exactly. You know, life isn't worth living if you can't irritate your
adversary. Can't piss off the Russophobes out there. Okay. When the U.S. sells weapons to Turkey or Saudi Arabia, it's a contract arrangement. And in the contract, there's very specific legal clauses that would put, you know, I mean, so if these were, if this was done, that would be the end of the relationship. How do we guarantee it's not done? Well, all the things that we're not doing in Ukraine, all the accounting procedures that we're not doing in Ukraine, we do when we sell weapons to Turkey or Saudi Arabia. Usually, sales of this nature have a technical support, a maintenance support package assigned to it. You usually have U.S. military advisors or technical experts that are there, and they monitor this, and there's constant accountability to make sure that everything is okay. And it's not just the specific technology. Sometimes there's derivative technology. The Israelis, for instance, built a fighter. I believe it was called the Lavi, L-A-V-I, Lavi fighter. And it was built using derivative American technology, which is protected. But the Israelis, next thing you know, the United States has taken a satellite photograph of a Chinese airfield, and there's a Lavi fighter sitting there on the airfield in an airfield that's known to be related to research and development. And the Israelis got in a little bit of trouble for that, because even though they didn't, provide, a direct U.S., fighter plane, an F-16 or something, they provided U.S. technology or Israeli technology developed jointly with the United States, which is therefore still controlled. So, that's something that is part of the contract, and the U.S. has definite security, systems in place to make sure this stuff isn't turned over to the Russians or the Chinese or anybody else.
Okay,
Kevin. Did I make the timer, or is the timer not working?
No, you made it.
Because I felt like I was loquacious on that answer.
Well, it's, how you feel and what it is aren't necessarily in sync.
Wow. See how strict he is? See how strict he is?
Kevin, I see you start Jeff Goodrich's question, so let's save that for later when we go to the live questions. And moving on to Luca from Kharkov, Russian Federation. I had to make it in a lower font to fit it all in.
But you do understand that Kharkov it's spelled properly, but it's occupied by Ukraine. It's actually technically part of Ukraine. So for him to say Russian Federation, it gives away his heart and soul, He's being sarcastic and just luring us in.
Well, I knew it was some kind of attitude, and I felt it was worth conveying the attitude. So I used a smaller font to make it fit. That was an executive decision I made. What is the best way for Russia to assist Serbia in the current crisis? How can Russia, if she so desires, transfer humans and material to Serbia without risking its transport planes being shot down by NATO?
First of all, it would be ludicrous. No matter how many troops Russia and equipment Russia can transfer via airplane, it's not the ideal way to do that. The Berlin airlift, the supply of the city of Berlin in the early moments of the Cold War, it required a tremendous amount of aircraft resources, and it's very difficult to do something like that. And if the Russians had wanted to shut down the land bridge, they could have done that in a heartbeat. Let's say Russia flies in thousands of troops. Now they have to sustain them, equip them, et cetera. And then the land bridges cut, those troops are isolated. So it's not a good situation to get yourself in. Plus, I don't see Russia wanting to get involved in a shooting war with NATO with Serbia. It's a losing proposition. You can't build up sufficient forces in there to have a meaningful impact. Anything you provided would be a tripwire force, saying to NATO, I dare you to attack these Russian troops, therefore the next thing will happen, which would be a major escalation, et cetera. So I don't think they're gunning for a military solution. Plus, Serbia, understand, Serbia got the snot bombed out of them back in 1999 by NATO. And even though they've upgraded their military, they upgraded air defense, the same result would happen. I mean, NATO might lose a couple more airplanes, but Serbia would get the snot bombed out of it again, and they don't want that. And there's another aspect to this too. There's, I think, 3,500 NATO troops in Kosovo. These are those elite NATO shock troops that know how to fight. Oh, no, no, they're NATO troops that don't know how to fight. Those 3,500 troops are at risk too. So NATO's not in any rush to get involved in a shooting match either, because they could get embarrassed. You know, you don't have to go too far back in time to understand there was a time when Dutch peacekeepers were on the ground in Srebrenica, and they were surrounded by Serbian forces and had to surrender. It was humiliating for the Dutch, and it led to the Srebrenica, massacres. You could see a situation easily where 3,500 NATO troops, the Germans, the Lithuanians, et cetera, were surrounded, had to surrender. Humiliation for NATO, because the Serbs will be able to bring more ground power to bear on the problem than NATO can reinforce. So, and the last thing NATO wants is a fight in the center of Europe while they're working on Ukraine. The last thing Russia wants is a distraction in the center of Europe. Neither side wants to be distracted. So I think that this will not be a military outcome. I don't think it's about Russia providing military support. It's about Russia providing political support, economic support, diplomatic sort of the same as political support. I think that's what Russia is going to work on. And the idea is to find some sort of compromise situation that brings this issue to a closure. We have an idea what that compromise would look like, eventual recognition of Kosovo. But Kosovo would give up the Serbian populations to Serbia. So Serbia would take control of them, autonomy for other isolated pockets of Serbs, something of that nature to avoid the fight, a fight.
Okay, let's go to New York. And Zizay, say in parentheses, very important to mention that, of course. Do you have any ideas regarding how we can shut down Heroes Park in Ellensville, New York?
Yeah, make it a hate crime. Get Stepan Bandera recognized as the murderous, brutal thug that he is. Here we're walking. Okay, now I got to take a step back, Jeff.
I was about to disagree with you, and you know
thank
that.
Thank you. I know you were, and I understand the legitimacy of your claim. Freedom of speech. Freedom of speech.
No such thing as a hate crime.
Oh, no. When I commit a hate crime, it's a hate crime because I would hate the person as I hit them.
All right. Go ahead with your revised answer, and I'm glad that you're revising it.
No, freedom of speech. I mean, on the one hand, you can't claim to be a proponent of free speech, and on the other hand, sit there and try and shut people down. I don't know if we can shut down Heroes Park in Ellensville. What we can do is delegitimize the cause that it represents by speaking out, by educating people about the horrific nature of Stepan Bandera's odious ideology. Like that, Jeff, and things of that nature. I would never ever be a proponent of physical damage. It's somebody's property. Let them have their property. Let them do what they want to do on that property. If they want to hold hate parades, hold hate parades. Back in the day, I always told people that I would, one of my jobs would in defending free speech is to, for instance, give you the right to burn the American flag. Personally, I'd like to kick your ass if you burn the American flag. I would stomp you in the ground if I had my druthers, but I can't because it's freedom of speech. The Supreme Court has said that is free speech, and therefore my job, as difficult as it is to protect you, is to secure your right to burn the American flag. Therefore, by extension, my job is to secure the right of these hate-filled Stepan Bandera lunatics to have Heroes Park and worship the bust of a mass murderer.
All right. You mentioned the flag burning case. Do you know which Supreme Court justice voted that is a crime? Somebody who you have admired in a previous one of our debates.
Well, I don't admire any Supreme Court justice, but what?
Well, you pointed to his decision as one that you agreed with in Citizens United. I'm talking about John Paul Stevens. He is an emotionalist, or was an emotionalist, and he is the liberal judge who thought that should be a crime.
Well, here's the thing here's the reason why I might agree with him on that.
Oh, God.
Well, don't oh God me. I mean, the American flag, according to law, is the living embodiment. Now you can get Congress to change the laws. Nobody's enforced it or whatever, but this, you know, the flag isn't simply a piece of cloth. It's the living embodiment of the nation. This is why the Marine Corps takes it dead serious that the flag doesn't touch the ground. This is why when we hold ceremonies to raise the flag and lower the flag, it's done in strict accordance with rules and regulations designed to preserve the integrity of the flag. The flag is a serious document, so I can understand why this emotionalist might have opposed that. But, you know, notice what I said. I said that I personally would want to beat the living dog poop out of you.
Right, but that's fine. But as a man,
the Supreme Court made a decision. Yeah. And I have to respect that decision.
All right. Good. Me too. And Kanye West should be allowed to be an anti-Semite too, right? All right. Next question.
Sure, but you don't have to buy his records.
Yeah. All right. Emmanuel from Virginia. I heard that the top Ukrainian military chief has said Russia is going for Kiev again. What do you think, Scott?
I think Russia is going to focus on accomplishing the primary tasks, which are to secure the Donbas, liberate or conquer, depending on your point of view, Donetsk. What's, you know, a significant percentage of Donetsk is still occupied by Ukrainian forces. You know, all the fighting in Bakhmut, all along that line, that's on the territory of Donetsk. So they need to complete the task of liberating this, and then they need to push the Ukrainians back outside of artillery range. That's, 120 kilometers. Guy disagrees with me. That's okay. and then while you're up there in that area, you're going to have to secure yourself from Kharkov. So you're going to do that. you eventually have to resecure Kherson, Zaporizhia, and push out with a buffer zone there. And the point I'm trying to make is there's a lot of work to be done down in the south and in the east. Why would you open up a second front? Pushing on Kiev, it would be a major operation with major logistical support requirements, a major, it would take away, significant military power that you need at the point of decisive engagement. So I disagree with the Ukrainian general. I don't think the Russians are going to make a push on Kiev. Of course, tomorrow the Russians will announce a major offensive from Belarus to Kiev, and everybody goes, "Britain's wrong again." That's okay. I don't care. You ask me what I think now, I'm telling you, from a military perspective, I think it's dumber than dirt. The only way it works is it's a lightning strike that succeeds. They tried that once. It didn't work. They did the whole shape the battlefield thing, which did work. But now, you know, they're shaping the battlefield as we speak. The fact that a Ukrainian general is thinking this means that they have to put forces in position just in case Russia does that. So I think that's what Russia is doing, creating the potential that Ukraine can't ignore it. But to be honest, Russia should have learned from what happened in September. You don't overextend your forces because then you open yourself up to a counterattack. The Ukrainian army, no matter how much you have them on the ropes right now, is still a potent fighting force, and you don't want to create a situation where, you know, they're allowed to sting you. Your job is to sting them. So no, I don't think they're going to make a move on Kiev. I think the Russians are going to be solely focused on running the kind of campaign that I've already discussed.
Okay. Buku Dinky Dao. Really hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I don't want to be disrespectful to anyone.
Well, that's straight out of the Vietnam War. Buku Dinky Dao. Okay.
What are the implications if Russia places nuclear weapons in Belarus?
Well, the implications are clear that Russia is redefining European security framework. Russia has complained for some time now about the NATO nuclear umbrella that basically allows non-nuclear powers like Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, Turkey to deliver nuclear weapons in time of war. So they have aircraft that are basically certified to be nuclear delivery systems. The pilots are trained. There's special electronics and equipment on the aircraft, so you can put a B-61 bomb on board and they can go and bomb Russia with nuclear weapons. Russia said that this has to end. Next time we have a strategic nuclear negotiation, these weapons have to be on the table. But the United States says, no, they're NATO weapons. We can't negotiate them. That's NATO. So basically, what Russia is doing now is creating the same thing with Belarus. They're saying, yeah, Belarus are going to have aircraft that are certified to carry nuclear weapons, and we're going to designate special weapons to be used on these aircraft, just directly replicating what the United States has done. And they're even upping the ante, saying that basically they have now Iskander missiles instead of the old Tochka missiles, the Iskander missiles that can be outfitted with nuclear weapons as well. So Russia is basically calling NATO's not bluff, but just telling NATO, you know, you want to anti-nukes? We're anti-ing with Belarus too. And what this does is it brings Belarus into a collective security arrangement and extends the Russian nuclear umbrella to Belarus, which now, if you remember when there was that election back in Belarus a couple years ago, in August of 2020, I believe, when the Baltics and Poland were talking about creating a color revolution and encouraging the overthrow of Lukashenko, this will never happen again, because now Belarus has a economic union and a security union with Russia. So Belarus is Russia. It's the Russian-Belarus version of Article 5 of the NATO Charter. So I think Russia has redefined the security framework for Europe. And NATO is now on a back foot trying to figure out what the heck to do about this.
Moving on to Manchester, England, and Steve Jackson. The West used Ukraine to get Russia to invade. How will they trap Iran into a military conflict? What sort of situation planned by the West will cause Iran to invade Iraq or Syria to get them stuck in those countries?
Iran's never going to invade Iraq or Syria. They don't. They have no need to invade Iraq or Syria. I mean, they have a presence in Iraq. They use the Quds Force. They have pro-Iranian militias in Iraq. In Syria, they have a limited number of forces that deploy there at the invitation. Why would you have to invade Syria if the Syrian government invites you? I mean, that shows you a mindset. In the West, we only can envision being in a country if we invade them. But for the Iranians, you know, they're invited by the Syrians. So they're already there. And the Iranians aren't stupid. The Iranians are very... they're very savvy people. They've done a good job of taking a weak hand and playing it very well regionally. Despite all of the sanctions and such that the U.S. has put on Iran, Iran is a dominant player in the region. So I don't see Iran falling into a trap anytime soon. They're there. If Iran is attacked, then... Iran will respond accordingly, but Iran's not in the business of invading nations, so I don't see it happening.
M from Illinois, you signed your name to a memo in response to the VIPS memo. That's Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, regarding the Russian hacking. That was a few years ago. What is your current view of whether or not Russia was behind the hack of the DNC? Was it a hack at all?
Well, I didn't just sign my name. I wrote the damn memo. It's not like I'm like, oh, somebody did the work. I'm just going to sign my name. I wrote the memo that said, I don't accept what VIPS is saying. They were talking about this theory of...
Let's clarify. There was something that VIPS issued on that topic. And you
correct.
And yours was one of the signatures there. So you're saying there was two
things? No. Well, when we're talking about hacking, it's two. I did not buy off on the VIPS. Now we're getting into VIPS. First of all, I support VIPS and all of its thing. Yeah. They got ahead of themselves, I believe, in publishing a memorandum that sought to prove again, a long time ago, but...
Yeah, I know, but I see, because of this question, I searched for it, and what I found was, the heading was the DNC hacking, and then a list of names, and yours is one of the names. So maybe that's what the person is asking about. But
I don't know what he's asking for. I know there was controversy between me and VIPS
about
a thumb drive, about data that was released that they claimed came out of a subsequent hack or a subsequent release of data in July. And I said, no, that this simply couldn't happen, that you can't make these assumptions, et cetera. You know, I tell you what, Jeff, why don't we put an asterisk next to this one? Because I'm going to say, I know exactly what I'm talking. I took these guys on and I won. I'm right. I'm 100% right on this one. So I don't know.
All right. Well, I'll email you what I found, because we don't know whether this guy is.
I don't know what he's talking about. What I would ask the individual that sent the question in, send something to Jeff that says, this is the memorandum you're talking about. Let's make sure that I'm answering the right question.
Okay. You know? That's
because I'm getting all spun up on something and it may be totally, innocent. He may be talking about something totally different.
Okay. Dave from Izmir. You know what country Izmir is in, Scott?
Turkey.
Of course. I'll never stump you. Maybe someday. I don't recall Scott discussing the implications of Victoria Nuland's admission to U.S.-funded biolabs in Ukraine. Why might that be? Now, I don't know if the question is why haven't this person heard you talking about it, or why might it be that Victoria Nuland did that?
I don't know. Why might that be? Well, I'm a paid agent of Russia, apparently. I get money from RT for writing the occasional op-ed piece. That might have influenced me. I think I recall last time Putin gave me the briefcase of money. He said, don't talk about Victoria Nuland. Don't talk about
her. You're taking it that way. But Dave might have meant, why did Victoria Nuland admit to U.S.-funded biolabs?
Okay. Well, why didn't she, or why did she?
Yeah. Well, I think according to Dave, she did. She did admit, and he's saying, why might that be? I don't know. That might be you could take this two ways.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me put it this way. I have discussed the implications of Victoria Nuland's admission. You just probably, Dave and Izmir, don't follow the totality of what I've talked about or written about. I've talked about biolabs extensively. I've talked about Victoria Nuland's statement. When you say admission, she's not admitting to anything. It's a matter of public record what we did in Ukraine. Okay, it was all done in, you know, a contract vehicle from the Defense Threat Reduction Agency through the Cooperative Disarmament Nunn-Lugar. You know, it's not top secret that we had biolabs in Ukraine. Some of the work that was done was sensitive. Victoria Nuland has acknowledged that there was this work going on. But, you know, forget Victoria Nuland. She's not the player. The player was the Defense Threat Reduction Agency official who, prior to the Russian invasion, said, hey, I'm a little bit worried that Russia might hit one of these facilities, damage the refrigeration, violate the integrity of the you know, storage facility, and things will be released in the air. And then he said the amazing thing was to include pathogens dating back to the Soviet times. And I'm like, whoa, I think Article 1 of the Biological Toxin Weapons Convention, you can't retain this stuff. Why you mean there's this stuff in this in bat labs that you control? You know, so retention and development, we're looking at, you know, some serious problems. So I don't understand the question, to be honest, because, the bottom line is Victoria Nuland's, a lot of people jumped on her statement, I believe it was made before Congress, where she answered a very specific question. It's a non-entity. It's literally has no bearing on anything, because this is much bigger than that statement. And I have talked about it. I've talked about it extensively. And Maverick is pissed off.
All right, let's take some live questions. Kevin, you got some good ones for our favorite weapons inspector? These are questions we've had submitted in advance. And if you want to do that for future episodes, go to scottritterextra.com and click on Ask the Inspector, and you'll see how to do it. You can also leave voicemail messages. You don't have to do it by text. And now we're going to take some live questions from our YouTube and Facebook audience. Joe Marsh, if Russia tried to do legitimate elections through the UN or another party prior to invading, allowing Ukrainian provinces to leave, do you think the response from the West would have been lessened?
spill wouldn't have happened. I mean, the Ukrainian provinces are, you know, sovereign Ukrainian territory. Russia has no legal basis to you know, try and do things like that. It's like saying if Mexico wanted to come into, you know, California and hold a referendum, what will the response of the United States be? Tell Mexico to go pound sand. The only way these referendum were ever going to occur, referenda, I guess, were if, you know, Russia did what it did, occupied the territories, and then carry them out. It's a very difficult situation. It's a, you know, it's a problem that, you know, many nations face when you're dealing with, you know, ethnicities. For instance, take Serbia and Kosovo. I mean, you know, ideally Serbia could hold a referendum in Kosovo and have, you know, the Serbs vote to join Serbia. Maybe they already did. I don't know. But, you know, here's the problem. The United Nations right of self-determination is not a all powerful right. If you're somebody who lives under the sovereign control of a nation whose borders are recognized by the United Nations, it's virtually impossible to have this kind of referendum. The only way that it can have is if Russia invades and occupies these territories.
All right. Another question, Kevin? Jeff Goodrich. Nice name, Jeff. Okay, you talked me into it. And thanks for the tip. Scott, what is the most surprising advancement of successful tactics on the battlefield, in your opinion, and how should we adapt in the U.S.?
Well, I would say there's two aspects. First of all, this is a war that's completely different from how the U.S. would wage a conflict. You know, the Russians emphasize artillery. So this is a very artillery intensive conflict, and they use artillery different than we do. We emphasize precision fires. So we use less artillery than the Russians do. The Russians emphasize mass fires. The Russians use artillery in ways that we would employ close air support. So, you know, they remove the need to have aircraft over the battlefield to the extent that the United States is accustomed to. So I would say that from the American perspective, or from the Western perspective, the role of artillery is, it's still there. It's the queen of battle. And we're not prepared to fight that kind of war. The other thing is drones. We've been developing drones for some time. Nations have been using drones. We've seen drones used to great effect by Turkey in Syria, by the Azerbaijanis against the Armenians, and then again by Turkey in Libya. And we've seen drones used effectively by the Ukrainians against the Russians, and now the Russians against the Ukrainians. And drones are used tactically and strategically. The Geranium 2 or the Shahed 136 drone has been a game changer for Russia in terms of their ability to strike Ukrainian strategic targets. So drone warfare too. And there's a lot of things going on with drones that were just not, you know, there's not as sexy as blowing up something, but the electronic warfare version, the reconnaissance, the how you incorporate the intelligence gathered by drones into battle planning, drone survivability. I think there was a lot of people, myself included, who didn't think the drones would have a very big impact on the modern battlefield because they would get blown out of the sky. And while drones are suffering casualties, the fact is the drone has shown itself to be a relatively survivable platform on a battlefield that has intensive anti-air capabilities. So I think the drone has been one of the major game changers in this Ukrainian battlefield.
All right, we have time for a couple more live questions from Serge. Hey, Serge, what's happening, dude? Do you think Zaluzhny could be useful for anything other than signing the unconditional surrender like Keitel did in May of 1945? After all, the Russians know about his selfies with Bandera just as well as you do.
No, I think Zaluzhny's role is exactly what you said. He is somebody that the Russians are positioning to be a credible interlocutor, a lot of syllables there, on the negotiating table where Russia dictates the terms of certain Russia. I don't think Zelensky's that figure. I don't think Russia would even bother with Zelensky. They can't. He's a Nazi. They're not going to deal with him. Zaluzhny is somebody. Russia, even though they've seen the selfie, Russia has said repeatedly recently that he's a man of honor. He's carried out a decent fight. He's done a good job. He's a professional. And so they're creating the aura of legitimacy around him so that when he sits down opposite his Russian counterparts who are dictating the terms of surrender, the Russian people will say, that's a negotiation we can accept, as opposed to, you know, having Zelensky there. I think that would, you know, take away from the legitimacy and credibility of any negotiated solution. So I think Zaluzhny, though, that's the limits of his utility. I don't see Zaluzhny as a post-conflict leader of Ukraine. He's forever tainted with the stain of his involvement with Zelensky and with this entire conflict, to include his selfie with the Bandera portrait.
Okay. What else we have, Kevin? Nomayor one. Thank you, Nomayor. Hi, Scott. What do you think that the U.S. realistically still expects to achieve by continuing the situation in Ukraine?
That's a good question, because I'll just state it right up. Ukraine's lost this conflict. They're not going to win this conflict. They're going to lose this conflict. And there's nothing the U.S. can do to alter that outcome without committing suicide, i.e. nuclear weapons, NATO intervention, things of that nature that U.S. says they're not willing to do. You know, they doubled down on stupid by providing, you know, the Patriot air defense, but the Patriot air defense system, unless there's some secret group of Ukrainian air defense specialists who have already received training, you know, it takes 5 months to train a Patriot operator. Let's say the United States takes shortcuts, does it in 3 months. But when you do shortcuts, mistakes are going to be made. The Patriot is a very complex system. It's not going to have any impact on the battlefield. It's not going to stop the Russians from blowing the hell out of the Ukrainian infrastructure now or initiating offenses in the near future that are designed to defeat the Ukrainian military. I think what the U.S. is doing right now is playing, you know, politics, both to appease a global audience and to shape a narrative here at home that we didn't abandon the Ukrainians, that we, you know, all the while putting as much pressure on the Ukrainians as possible to negotiate a surrender that basically insulates the United States from criticism. So the United States can say, we supported it up until the very end, but, you know, it was always up to Ukraine to make a decision how much they wanted to do. And Ukraine's decided that they've had enough and they're going to surrender, and we support that surrender. So I think that's what's going on. The U.S. just creating the political perception that they're backing Ukraine 100%, all the while begging Ukraine to come up with a negotiated settlement that doesn't give Russia the complete victory that Russia's about to achieve. And again, even if Ukraine decided they want to have that negotiation, there's no guarantee Russia will ever negotiate with the West again after what happened with Angela Merkel and the Minsk II Accords.
All right, we're coming up on 1 hour. Let's squeeze in one more question. Christopher Dobby, what do you think of the new world economic vote?
I don't understand the question.
Me neither. That last word, vote, really threw me.
Order? A new world economic order?
I don't know.
I guess the new world economic vote. I don't know. I mean, I'll run with this. I'll say, you know, if he's talking about, you know, the emerging role of BRICS, the BRICS Economic Forum, as a direct competitor to the G7 and the United, you know, in the U.S., you know, dollar hegemony over the global economy, I think it's the natural progression of global reality. The day of dollar dominance is over. We're going to see competing currencies, competing economies. And if that what you mean by a vote, that they're now, that they have a say in the global affair, I think it's a good thing. I don't think any one nation should have the ability to impose its will on others, especially economically. I mean, you know, people work too hard for their living, and they don't need outside powers coming in trying to, and they have enough problems with, you know, working with their own governments and their own systems to earn a living. You don't need the United States coming in trying to dictate how you do business. We've done that for too long now. And I think it's a good thing. If this is what you're talking about, basically the world voting to create a new world economic order to escape American economic hegemony, I think it's a good thing.
Okay. Later tonight at 7:30 Eastern time, we'll do Scenes from the Evolution with my lovely co-host, Tori Mansfield, the winsome savant. And our guest will be information warfare expert, Kevin Michalitzi, who writes for Scott Ritter Extra. And he's backstage now. Do you want to come on and say a quick hi, Kevin, and give folks a little, no problem if you're not ready. Maybe you're not even, there you are. How you doing? So we just published a new article today about a poll that Elon Musk took, and it looks like he's not going to be the head of Twitter for long. That's what your article's about. We'll be talking about that later. Want to give us just a 30-second summary of it?
Yeah, he has to quit before he unbans Scott, so Scott gets a beer.
Okay, so we'll expound on that further. There's Scott verifying that he's still banned.
And will always be banned.
All right, well. The sun, at least you'll get a free beer out of me if that's
in Texas.
That is correct. All right. So thanks for helping us out backstage, Kevin.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
This is our final Tuesday Ask the Inspector of the year. We're going to take next week off, but we will be on this Friday night at the usual time, 8 p.m. Eastern time. And will you be doing anything special? Will you be wearing a Santa hat or anything cute like that? Or we'll just have to wait and see.
We'll just have to wait and see, Jeff.
All right. I look forward to it. And I hope all our regular viewers tune in so we can give each other electronic hugs for the great start we had to this whole thing. And we look forward to much more next year. Thanks for watching.